This is Developer Stories, where we ask you why you built it, and we look behind the scenes of some of tech's passion projects and people. Welcome to the show. You're in the right place.
Welcome to Developer Stories. I'm Vanessa Sockett, and I'm thrilled to introduce Alan Sill, Managing Director of the High Performance Computing Center at Texas Tech University, President of the Open Grid Forum, Co-Director of the National Science Foundation Cloud and Autonomic Computing Center, and how I know him best, co-founder of the HPC Social Community, where we have a ton of fun. So Alan, happy holidays. Welcome to the show.
Well, fantastic. And I won't miss a second to say that you are, of course, the other primary co-founder of HPC.social, though we've had a lot of help from friends.
Definitely. We have a lot of friends in the space, and that's one of the things that makes it so fun. And I probably didn't do justice in your introduction because you have such a wide reach and rich history, but I'm hopeful we can hit upon some of those points in our discussion today. So let's go back in time a little bit. I want to start with your training. Can you take us back to when you started getting interested in computers and or science and how that ultimately led you to a PhD program?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, that was just a fancy way of saying I'm old. And what I've learned about all these things I've accumulated is that not a single one of them gets me a discount at Starbucks. So one shouldn't be too impressed with the list. But it is a pretty long list. I got started in science. It was in high school that we had a physics teacher who was really cut above. He was a retired Navy officer, quite an older gentleman, and I found him fascinating. And I had taken the course a year early, mostly because I wanted to skip biology for reasons that would take too long to explain. But I ended up with physics a year early, and I found it fascinating. And at the end of the first semester, you know, we got our grades and I had a D. And I had never had such a low grade before. And I asked him, why did I get a D? And he said, you didn't turn in the work. So that was kind of the last time I made that mistake. I worked really, really hard. And then he asked me to be his laboratory assistant the next year. And unfortunately, that year he passed away suddenly. And we were devastated. Then the school kept sending us these substitute teachers who didn't know a thing about physics. And so the other lab TA and I would just intercept them at the door and hand them the lesson plan and say, this is what Mr. Dickey would cover. Do what you can and then break to lab. And then we basically would take everything down, all of the lecture demonstration equipment, all of the experimental equipment, and try to keep the class going that way. And by the end of that year, I decided I wanted to be a physicist. And I got to college and I marched in with my briefcase. Oh, what a cringe memory. And I sat down, took out my four-year plan for my degree, mentioned that I was a little uncertain about what to take in the second semester of my senior year, asked if there were any questions. So I was really kind of determined to be a scientist from the outset. Now, computers were not on the scene, at least not at the level that would intersect, you know, an undergraduate in a small liberal arts college. So it took a little while for that aspect. I had a slide rule and I prided myself in beating the people with the calculators until they came out with one of the square root function. And then I realized it was over and I learned that technology. I took jobs as an undergraduate assistant in various places. Started with the Bonneville Power Administration, and they had a CDC 6500, a mainframe computer. And I had taken in the meantime, I had taken a class at my college, which had one computer. It was owned by the administration. We used it to do payroll. They let us do programming in the evenings on it. Can you imagine that in our current security environment? So I had learned to program, and they let me at the 6500, and I shamelessly took advantage of being a very young, innocent-looking kid by abusing that privilege to get tours of the facility and so forth and get my printouts early. For me, it always was partly the science. I left that job because they were, it's way too long a story, but they were not really interested in advancing beyond their sort of current way of doing things. And I took a job with the Oregon State Health Division in a lab doing environmental radiation monitoring. So for me, it was always coupled, the computing was always coupled with the science. In this case, we used computers to analyze samples taken from the environment to look for possible contamination and do, you know, help public health protection. And when I graduated, I really didn't know what to do. So I just kind of kept doing that, got a job with the federal government. And once again, I discovered that the scientists in the lab I worked in were not really interested in the science. They were just 9-to-5ers. I ended up selling my house and going back to grad school and taking, so it, all along the way, I sort of accumulated an amount of computing knowledge that always is kind of an extra tool. So the early stories for me are all about sort of mixing science and trying to learn what I could about the natural world with computing methods, because they always seemed easy to me and I couldn't understand people for whom they were hard. You know, that led me to graduate school, again, mostly because I was unhappy with what I didn't know. So, you know, next question, otherwise I'll keep rambling like this for a long time.
So an interesting thought I had is that people are motivated by very different things. And it sounds like for you, there was this magical combination between science and computers, and that passion for your work has always been intimately linked. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah. And it's still the case. So somewhere along the way in the last, well, I'll confess, it was in 1974 that I took my first computer programming class, which was called Numerical Methods in Mathematics, because they didn't have a computing course per se. And that was the way that they forced it into the curriculum. So, you know, I've seen a lot of change, but somewhere along the way, I switched to computing being the primary thing that I do. And that part of the story is probably interesting, so maybe we can come back to it. But it's still the case that I start from the science. I'm happiest when I can encounter, you know, so right now I run a high performance computing center, and also we have a research center in cloud, as you mentioned. And I'm happiest when someone comes to us with a problem and we ask them to try to please clear the decks. Don't limit your request to what you think we can do. Tell us what you're working on. Are you trying to cure cancer? Are you trying to solve supernovas? Or, you know, let us come up with a suggestion of the best computing for you. I'm actually interested at this stage in expanding that work beyond pushing for the largest access to the largest computers, which was my focus for a long time, or the largest collaborations, and back towards trying to explore the other dimension, which is, you know, pretty much every field these days has something to do with data. At least someone in every field is doing some sort of data related analysis. But the tools, there's a patchwork of how these tools are integrated into these disciplines. So I'm interested in expanding beyond the few percent of the university that I help right now, and trying to take seriously meeting the needs of the rest of these fields with, you know, increasingly easy to use and yet correct methods.
Alan, we're going to need to clone you. That's a lot of things to take on.
I just follow my nose. It's really, I think I've noticed that about you too, that you get interested in something and you go after it. And to me, this is absolutely the best approach. I give this advice to graduate students all the time. They come to say, what should I work on? And I say, well, you know, what are you interested in? Your brain is this amazing pattern seeking device. You know, it's figured out stuff you're interested in. You may not know or be able to explain why you're interested in it, but you are, you know, so follow your instincts. And that's basically been my career path. It's led me to, you know, be a participant in discovering the top quark and coming up with the computing that helped find the Higgs boson, and do a whole bunch of other science along the way. But it's always been, you know, following my nose.
I really like that description, because it brings up, what was that, the Fruit Loops mascot? We're all just those really colorful birds that are following our noses. But it really is spot on. My brain definitely is sticky for things where I get interested in something and I have to know the details. I have to learn it. I have to try it out and get my hands so deep into it until I figure out like what I can build with it. It's just kind of fun, I suppose. But it's interesting because my incentive structure is very much not tied as much to the science. I like the very generic aspects of technology that could help many kinds of science, but I've always been a really bad scientist because I've never been motivated just by the scientific questions, which is sort of why I asked that question in the first place. But I think it's interesting that we both follow our noses regardless. Yeah. You said something in your original story. You called your briefcase memory a cringe memory. And can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I was probably the classic geek. I mean, the glasses and the briefcase and the slightly not long enough pants. And my friends actually at one point in college trapped me and said, "We're going to the store and you're going to buy some jeans. We can't stand those pants on you any longer." Yeah. I guess I've gotten by in life by having friends that intervene from time to time, you know.
Gotcha.
I refused to see the original Star Wars, and they just kidnapped me and said, "Look, you're coming."
Did you like it?
Yeah. So, you know, your pattern seeking device is not necessarily an infallible guide as to what's good for you, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Sounds like you had good friends too that were looking out for you.
I have. And for me, collaboration has, you know, I've always thought of myself as an individual and very much a loner and kind of, but as it turns out, my career has taken kind of the opposite path. I've sort of been forced into situations where I had to work with large numbers of people to get things done. I guess an example would be when I started my postdoc, it was in Japan. You know, I got near graduation and we were about to get married, and I sat down with my wonderful fiance and showed her all the places in the world that particle physics was done. And I said, "Where would you like to go?" And her mother is Japanese and she had family in Japan. And she said, "You know, could we go to Japan?" So we went there, and all of the computing was done on Fujitsu Facom mainframe. They were clones of IBM 360s. You know, clone is maybe a little unfair, but they were in the same category. You know, card readers and some terminal access, but it was a timeshare system. At that time, the VAXs were very popular in the US. Our universities were buying them, and my university wanted to have me help convert the code from Facom to VAX. So this is an object lesson for anyone who finds themselves in this situation. You know, I did what I thought was the sensible thing. I announced VAX conversion meetings and set times and meeting rooms, and nobody showed up. But I also got interested in the code. I was fascinated with Kalman filters at the time, and there were things in the code that looked crude to me, so I replaced them. And of course, when I replaced them, the code was obviously VAX compatible because that was, you know, my mandate. We would call it a commit these days. I would submit my code for adoption and say, "Look, it works, it's faster." And this is the mantra that carried me through much of the next part of my career, which was, you know, if you want to find ways to have people adopt stuff, you know, first it has to be correct. And second of all, it has to have some technical advantage. In this case, speed was essential. But in the process, what we were doing was slowly converting the code base to VAX compatible code. So this is my takeaway from that era of my life, is that if you want to talk people into doing things, the technical lead can be important. But it was also important that this be adopted, and the social aspect, which I failed at so miserably at first, you know, was informed by the technical part. So when I got back to the university, they had bought $1 million computer, a VAX 8800. It had two 8 mega instruction per second processors. It was an amazing thing. And we had this loose collection of VAXs throughout the US, and it became a social problem. Get the people to work together. And it was right about that time that NSF introduced the NSFNet. And before that, we had, you know, BitNet, which the joke is it was the bits stood for because it's there. You know, it was a bunch of modems, literally modems that we called each other's computers up with. And that's how we distributed code. And I had written the code that transferred the data across the Pacific over initially 9,600 baud lines. I mean, I know this sounds dinosaurs to you, but those were already amazing advances over what before. So when When NSFNet came along at, at megabit per second, it was just astonishing to us, and it transformed a lot. It's always been this interplay between, if you want to work in particle physics, you have to have lots of friends, and getting them to do what you think is right is, I don't at all want to leave the impression that my conclusion is that this is entirely a social problem. If anything, I'm arguing the opposite. Yes, you have to be aware of the sociology, but you have to have a technical driver. People will, readily adopt stuff under the right conditions. It works, it's faster. But you have to create those situations through some technical advantage. So, I guess one of my favorite stories from that, which I just told yesterday in the HPC huddle. Brief ad, if people haven't found the HPC huddle on hpc.social, they should look for it. It's a lot of fun. So we were talking about some things that one of the participants had done, modeling particles in magnetic fields. And I told the story about having studied the magnetic field of the collider detector at Fermilab and imperfections and non-uniformities in it, and found a numerical way to compensate for that, that could be applied to the data without reprocessing. Had also found a way to improve the calibrations of the detector. And I wanted to see if this was going to be adopted. So I kind of slipped into one of the meetings. Now, the time period of the top quark search for me exposed me to some of the most competitive, in both the positive and negative senses of that term, and hardworking, experiences in science I've ever had. And there was a group called the B tagging group. The way that you find the top quark is that it decays to the bottom quark, and the bottom quark lives long enough that it can travel a measurable distance away from the beamline before it decays. And so this is called B tagging. So the way you find it is you reconstruct all the particle trajectories and see if any intersect at places that are displaced from the beamline. That was the basic method. Well, it turned out that these non-uniformities in the magnetic field and so forth had a measurable effect on resolution. And I was able to compensate for that. And my service task for the experiment had been creating calibrations, including beamlines. So I kind of was working on both ends of this problem. And I just wanted to see if this stuff would be adopted. So I slipped into the meeting where this was being discussed. This B tagging group, the brightest, most hardworking, most competitive postdocs and students in the whole collaboration, full room at Fermilab. I found a place in the back. And the name of my kludge was 615 tracking. The releases of the code were followed numeral 61, 62, but 61 could be fixed with my method without having to reprocess. So I called it 615 tracking. I watched as the first postdoc walked up, put his, we used transparencies back then, put his first transparency down. And the conveners asked him, have you run 615 tracking on this? And he said, no. And he said, sit down. This was kind of shocking to me. I say this, I give this story, which is a brag, I admit, but I'm very, very proud of that work to show that you can't just influence large groups of people in science only with opinions and influencer type stuff. You have to lead with some improvement. With computers, you get into kind of a gray area as to what's an improvement for one person. It may depend on what you're trying to improve. Are you trying to improve the ability to conduct surveillance capitalism? So you have kind of a moral dimension that's kind of absent from science. And I guess I've liked the science for that reason as well, that there's usually a slightly simpler set of moral issues. My work always led me in the direction of trying to get things done in a setting where there were lots of people. I kind of slowly learned how to get along with folks. I never felt particularly natural at it, but I ended up leading large groups of people at times, and I was always most comfortable doing it when I felt like a contributor.
I definitely think you should be proud of that story. I'm glad you told it too. I missed that particular HPC huddle. I think I stayed up too late and then I fell back asleep. That was a really cool story, and I'm hearing a lot of things, and I want to try to summarize for myself and for the listeners. So the first is that we have to do work that people care about. So early in your story, you can't just call a meeting and expect people to care enough to show up. And then the second kind of theme that keeps coming through is that you really often have to prove yourself. Often that comes through hard work, but not just working hard. It's also, you know, the cliche working smart. You have to do high quality work that makes sense in a context, again, that people care about. And then the third, which sounds like the hardest thing, and I would say this is the hardest thing for me too, is that you have to learn to be a little social. So doing the great work and, you know, figuring out the other things, that's not really enough. You have to be able to speak up at the table when it's necessary. You have to show up to meetings. Maybe when you first do that, you just listen, you learn, you absorb, you figure out how people work together. But then eventually, you have that opportunity to speak up, or you make an opportunity for yourself to be heard because you know you have something important to say. But the interesting thing about all these points is that there's this underlying theme that people are just really hard. So when you look back on all of your years of experience and you see how these experiences shaped you as a leader, how do you sort of apply this logic now that you are a leader and you look at people on your team and perhaps they don't have these insights?
Well, that's a really good question. So I guess the first thing I would do is question whether they don't have these insights. Experience brings humility at some point, and that's always a good point to start. You know, there's the usual techniques of making sure your boss thinks that all your work is their idea. That's a double-edged sword, and I guess I'll put that aside for a moment. The technique of repeating back to people what you have heard them say to help them feel listened to. There are mechanical things you can pick up. One shouldn't dismiss that there are reasons that people make these suggestions. And I would say that the more I've tried to sort of emotionlessly apply some of these things, the better I've gotten along. I've gotten better, you know, after 32 years at the university. It, you know, somewhere along the way, I picked up the ability to settle faculty arguments. I have no idea when that happened or how. I had a colleague at Hopkins once tell me, the reason you have to understand that faculty fights are so bitter is that they matter so little. And, you know, they're all about who has the bigger lettering on the department directory or stuff like that, you know, really trivial stuff. And dismissing things like that doesn't help solve the problem. So, you know, helping people hear, feel heard is a big piece of it. When I took over as vice president of standards for Open Grid Forum, grids were just at that point waning from their peak. You know, grids was an example of collaborative work for me, you know, and the message that I was just trying to type in response to a thread on one of our mailing lists about handling identity management in collaborative settings was that I've learned that these things, the technology is the easy part and the policy is the hard part. People, there are a lot of people who feel in charge of identity management, and none of them are wrong. And so you have to somehow get to a point where people feel heard, their issues are addressed, but they're not allowed to derail the direction of the organization. So when I took over as vice president of standards for Open Grid Forum, I asked the outgoing person, you know, if they had any advice, and there was a pause, and he said, you can't push a rope. And that phrase has stuck with me. You know, if you think yourself as a leader, as someone pulling people in various directions, I think you're going to set yourself up for frustration. If you try to reverse the direction instead of pulling, you're pushing. Again, people and organizations tend to be flexible and to move in ways that you don't anticipate. So what works the best is to help them do the things that they want to do in the most efficient fashion. So am I saying you can't have an effect as a leader? I think I'm saying the opposite. I think I'm saying that if you want to have the best effect as a leader, you have to, you know, listen a lot. This is standard advice, but you also have to apply what you've learned about efficiency to provide people with effective methods of doing something. I guess HPC.social is an example, right? We listened to the community, we did a survey, and then we took some action that tried to improve the efficiency of communication. So it's kind of a good little model of how I found works best to work in high technology areas, especially areas that require a lot of people.
To extend your rope analogy a little bit, I spent part of my time growing up on a farm, and we had a huge barn, a really old, like 200-year-old barn at the time. And it had this massive rope swing, like really big, heavy rope. And another thing that can happen with ropes is that it will be swinging, you know, you push it and then it comes back and it hits you and you, it totally takes you out. I was not a very large person. So that's something else that can happen. The kickback of the rope.
Yeah. Well, if we want to pursue physical analogies, that these days, given to this phrase, people ask me, you know, what I've learned about working with the university. And I tell people universities are a lot like elephants. You definitely don't want to get it mad. They can be destructive. The best way to get them to go in the direction you want them to go is by thinking about it ahead of time, having a plan, and gently prodding them over a long period of time so that the decision they make is the right decision. Universities are giant engines for making stupid decisions. And I say that with no rancor or hostility at all. It's just true. And the more important and the more high-level people involved in the decision, in my experience, the more likely it is to be a bad one. So you try to just avoid those situations. How do I get things done now? I do a lot of listening, and really there's just no substitute for that. I try to apply that prod when I think I know the right direction. It's sort of like my attitude towards software. I often tell students that the design philosophy is that the software should do the right thing by default, where it's possible to know in advance what the right thing is. Asking people a lot of questions is a hallmark of bad software, in my view. Putting the right levels of control in are important. So again, in organizations, you try to create situations where the decisions to be made are easily approached and approached in a neutral way and part of a long process that you establish that has listening at its core. So you're not blindsided by unexpected input.
Definitely agree. So you have been at your university elephant for over 30 years, and you went from a physics professor, now managing director in so many different roles. What has kept you there? I think that's really cool because it's surprising to see someone stay at the same institution for so long. So what's special about the Texas Tech University elephant?
Well, that's actually a very good question. I'll be very honest, and I hope I won't offend any of my local friends by saying I never intended to stay here that long. I'd come here because there was a particularly talented scientist who was the first person hired by the university to start a particle physics group here. He had an endowed chair. This was in the time period where the superconducting supercollider, a project which suffered the failure of having one too many supers in its name, was being built in Texas. There were startup groups at every university in Texas in particle physics. They had hired this guy from CERN, and he was actually famous. His name's Richard Wigmans, and he had come up with an understanding of a certain type of detector, a calorimeter, that moved very substantially beyond what people had known before about how they work. Particularly, he had solved a problem having to do with what controls their resolution for hadrons, for particles that are made of other particles. What was happening was a deep, insightful set of physics, and I wanted to know what it was about. And I had taken that interview in a long interview trip where I went to many universities, and taken that one specifically to ask him physics questions. I had no intention of taking the job. And by the way, here's a little job hunting hint for people who are looking for jobs. It's just, I'm not saying this is good advice. I'm just observed that the more the institution thinks they'll never be able to get you, the more interested they are in hiring you. And I don't know, I must have completely given off that vibe. I rushed through my interview talk as quickly as I thought I could do it. And I went to dinner with this eminent scientist, and I started asking him physics questions. And he and his wife were renting a house. They had no furniture. He had an espresso maker, and we stayed up late at night with him making too much espresso, and he kept answering my questions with really excellent science. And at the end, I called up my wife and I said, I think I found a good job. And she said, oh, which one? Because I'd gone to several places. And I said, the one in Lubbock. Hello? As she really did not want to come here. They had to actually pay for a second interview trip to get her out here, which I found later is never done. And but I had started out on science, and he hit me with this argument that I was defenseless against. He says, why don't you come here? You know, I know you've looked at these other places, but if you come here, then we'll start from scratch. Anything we do, we'll do on our own. It'll be our accomplishments. Any failures we have will be ours. And I was just defenseless against this argument. So I started out in physics, and I spent 10 years in physics. But through the part of the story that I didn't tell, and I'll pause to let you ask the question, but I had gotten deeply into grid computing, and I ended up switching from a research professor position that I had earned at that point to a job in the High Performance Computing Center to implement grid computing for the state of Texas. And after that, I was when that project was over, I was kind of at loose ends, and I decided that there was this new cloud thing, and I wanted to learn about it. And I had found out about a National Science Foundation program to have industry-funded research and industry university cooperative research centers. And I figured a bulk of the cloud computing development was going to be in industry. And I could either pay them to do stuff for us, or we could enter this program, and then the companies would pay us to help them with it. And I liked that second idea better. So we started, this was over 10 years ago, we started the National Science Foundation's cloud and autonomic. It took me 2 years to learn to say autonomic, also computing center, cloud and highly automated computing. When that project was pretty much at its peak, the director of our center here had retired and promoted his assistant as a replacement, but he encountered health problems. And I found that here was this fantastic organization that was suddenly leaderless, and I didn't want to see it fail. So I stepped in, and a couple of years later, they made me the managing director, and that's how I've ended up staying this long. I never intended to. It was kind of, always following my nose.
It sounds like you were ironically able to be more comfortable and really allow your interests and personality to come through by way of not caring so much about the outcome of the interview. You can imagine being really anxious or nervous and not having just the gumption or the confidence to have coffee and late to the wee hours of the morning asking all these questions. But probably what happened is you did that, and then the person you were talking to was like, I would really like to work with this person. They really care about the science. They're not, just kind of going through the hoops of the interview.
I agree, though I will say it was uncalculated on my part. I was genuinely curious. And so maybe the lesson is to be genuinely curious and follow your instincts again.
Yeah, I also hear a message about authenticity here. When we go and interview, we sometimes can choose to, put on a certain hat. Oh, I'm going to be my professor self or my scientist self. And it sounds like you were just your authentic self.
I had the fortune to have had some really good training. In my undergraduate school was one I have no idea how my parents afforded. I'd gotten a scholarship, a National Merit Scholarship, and I was able to go. And I found out years later, after, again, working for a couple of years and then going back to grad school, only then did I learn how good an undergraduate education I had had. I didn't actually realize. I mean, you just, right, you're in your own environment. You don't really had the weight of a way of comparing it. But I found that I was able to get through most of the first year of graduate school without really much effort because of the preparation. And when I finished my PhD, I had the good fortune to get hired by Ari Bodak at University of Rochester. And the Rochester Particle Physics Group was a machine. I mean, it was certainly the largest one that I was aware of. There were six experimental faculty in particle physics, and each one of them was, at the time that I was there, either the spokesperson or the co-spokesperson of their experiment. It was just an astonishingly powerful group, dozens of postdocs, and I don't know how many students. And they just gave me the opportunity to do a lot of stuff. I was always a hardware guy. I liked building detectors, and they, in exchange for running their VAX 8800, they let me start a particle detector project, and that was how they kept me. And that was what led me to
the Super Collider, and I had, again, the good fortune to get a fellowship, one of the fellowships being offered by the lab, the Texas National Laboratory Commission or something like that, Research Commission. So when I went to interview for this junior faculty position, I had a very strong background and kind of the ability to, you know, not pay attention to some of the less attractive opportunities. The ironic thing was I picked the one that had, you know, the sort of the least going for it, absolutely nothing in the way of facilities, prestige, anything. But that's made me the happiest.
Ah, that's some other good advice, is to pursue what makes you happy as opposed to something else. And then you find yourself unhappy and you're like, oh God, what have I done? I've learned that lesson the hard way early in my career, but then I've been able to make good choices after that.
I meant what I said early on. I have a long collection of things that don't get me a discount at Starbucks. You know, they may or may not be things that people aspire to, but what matters to me is the respect of people for whom I value that respect. You know, the sense myself that I've done something right. I'm very proud of the work on the top, the early days of what we didn't even know to call grid computing until Foster and Carl Kesselman came along and gave a name to it. And very proud of the work that has led me in the science directions. And now I have this just astonishing ability, which I value every bit as much, to not be in that pressure cooker, to sit back and be able to say, what can I do to get other people further down the road towards their science? And, you know, the great thing about running a high-performance computing center these days, or doing any related effort, is your ability to help other people do absolutely amazing things, at least if you're doing it right. Everything from pure science, gravitational waves and stuff like that, to, you know, pure implementation with all the fraught choices that comes with. But, you know, in a typical high-performance computing center, when we hire people, I tell them, look, you're going to talk with researchers, and inside of three sentences, they're going to expect you to understand everything about their field and why they're stuck on this particular line of code. If that's going to be a frustrating experience for you, then you should find another way to be happy. But if you like that kind of thing, this is the place for you. And we hire people for whom that is fun. And for me, it is a lot of fun. I feel like it's almost a cherry on top of my career, is I get this ability to feel like I'm helping other people pretty much every day I go to work.
Ah, now we're into ice cream metaphors. I like it. So let's go with that ice cream metaphor. And let's talk a little bit about HPC Social, which is where we get to practice this sort of helping and supporting others. We've talked about this in other venues. So maybe can you tell us the short story about HPC Social? So we have it on the books here.
Oh, yeah. I think we should probably refer people to Shane Kahn's, was it Inside HPC podcast? That you did a great job on that. And also the talk in the Easy Build community meeting 2 years ago now. We're just finishing a full year of operation of HPC.social. And the starting point was observing the tremendous rush of people trying to bail out of Twitter at the time. I had joined Twitter because I had found a technical community I could communicate with, and I liked it. And we were just sort of looking with dismay at some of the things that were happening there. Now, let me be fair and say, there are a lot of people still on it. I'm not, mostly, almost entirely, but I do keep an account there because there are a few people that I respect who are still active. But a large portion of the community seemed to be expressing some dismay at, you know, the lightening of and the removal of protections against certain kinds of hate speech and so forth, and, you know, various negative aspects of the platform, and just the desire to find alternatives. So on one of our Twitter chats, I had asked, can we have an alternative for HPC, and how about the domain hpc.social? Long story short is we ended up buying it and then immediately doing a survey to find out what we should do with it. And then that led to a Mastodon instance and other stuff. But, you know, the other stuff, including very active Slack and Discord channels, and now there are, I think, almost 400 people on Slack, and well over 500, like 550 or so on Mastodon. We've seen a little bit of a slowdown on the Mastodon signup rates. Discord seems to steadily be picking up people. But also, I was aware that you had been putting out really great ideas for a long time. Hey, let's have a community map of where our data centers are. And oh, hey, let's find ways of sharing, code that we're working on. And so included you in a group of people that I asked, what else can we do about it? And you jumped in and have built the website and a tremendous number of features. I just want to remind people that, and then you give you a chance to add to this description, that we have almost everything is managed through projects on GitHub. You find, github.com/hpc-social. You'll find the repositories that drive all of the website hpc.social content. And, we could use some help, but not everything is completely perfect, but we have a lot of really nice features. My favorite is the good first issues that you put together. That is just a fantastic resource that people should refer to every day, I think. So what's your memory of how it came about?
Oh, that's pretty similar, that a bunch of us came together and was like, we need a place to just have friends and talk. And it started with the surveys, and then it became a couple of chat channels and the Mastodon. And there are still some HPC people on Twitter, but the community has definitely died down there. And then we just built a whole bunch of stuff. We're like, what do people want? Oh, a jobs board? You got it. Good first issues? Like, yeah. Oh, place to like put community syndicated blogs? Of course. And I always go back to the question, like, oh, what should we make next? I want to kind of encourage listeners, like, I guess if you haven't joined one of the HPC social spaces, to come and join. We do talk about technical things, but we also post, we have a humor channel, and we post memes with, stupid, funny things. And that's kind of awesome too. And the HPC huddle is one of my favorite things, even though sometimes I sleep through it depending on the time. And I would say that if you have an idea for something fun, bring it to us, because, last year we had the Noodles Award, which was just totally silly and fun. And so this is the place to have fun with your friends. It's a place to learn. That's kind of my take. I'm interested to see like how we can improve in the future. So feedback is always welcome. We're coming up on time a little bit. I do want to bite and ask you quickly about grid computing, if you want to tell that story.
I had always worked in hardware and software, and I was working on the particle detector at the core of the experiment called a silicon vertex detector. And it was also working in software and getting a cup of coffee one day. We were using at that time, the lab had an Amdahl mainframe, which we didn't like much. There was a big VAX. And we had, in the trailers, we had developed a Renegade Alpha network, VAX and Alpha cluster, which was more powerful than the lab's resources. And we were kind of proud of it, but I was getting a cup of coffee and a friend of mine came in and said, we built a Linux cluster. And I said, oh, what do you do that for? He says, no, trust me, this is going to be good. Well, I mean, at that time, the only people who really built these Beowulf clusters were people like Los Alamos, and they were curiosities and used them to calculate pi and stuff. But they said, no, we had built this cluster and we're going to use it for the level 3 trigger, which is like the last decision-making step before you write the data to the tape. So yep, the process of collecting particle physics data is basically one of deciding what to keep, or as a friend of mine would say about the trigger, deciding what to throw away. So you had to try to keep the events that of the billions per second that happened that would have signatures that looked like the science you were looking for without losing them in the stuff you threw away. And so this last level of decision applied some of the offline software to winnow things down by another factor of 3. And they put 300 Linux, a core was a socket, was a pizza box back then. So 300 pizza boxes with one core each. Together, and that was our level 3 trigger, and that worked really well. And within a few months, they built, I can't remember if it was 1,000 or 2,000 of these to actually supplement our offline analysis. So this ended up quickly overwhelming the capacity we had with all the other resources that I mentioned. Then something interesting started to happen. People at other universities started to call us up and write us emails and say, can show us how you did that. And they put me in charge of a project to basically give people an instruction set. Do this, do exactly this. And if you do this and you have problems, contact me. And if you don't, have a nice day. And it was very much on the fly kind of thing. And they did. There were like a half a dozen places where they built these clusters that were close to the ones we had built at Fermilab. And then they did, after they took their picture with the dean in front of them and stuff like that, they did something really amazing, which is they called us up and said, what can we use them for? We want to participate in the analysis. And we realized we had stumbled accidentally into a solution to the huge computing problem we had in trying to track all the particles and looking for the top quark. So I got put in charge of this thing. Caffeine jokes were in vogue because Java was new back then. The central facility was called the CDF analysis facility. CDF is collider detector at Fermilab. So the CAF, in other words, and the distributed CAF was called the DCAF, and I was in charge of the DCAF project.
Oh no, nobody wants decaf. No, I'm just kidding.
So that we did that for, a couple of years. This was in the mid to late 90s, and right about that time was when the phrase grid computing started to be used. And this was Foster and Kesselman and others, largely at Argonne, running around giving talks about something that they called the grid. And the analogy was the electric grid. You'd, plug in and you'd get computing. But their idea centered largely, at least as I remember it, around what we would now think of as things like SETI at home or cycle scavenging work. We were sharing access to clusters, but they had a key insight, which was that if you do this stuff right, you can build something they called middleware. And the middleware would let you do this distributed computing for, all types of science or engineering or whatever else you needed to do. And this was the key insight, right? So these ideas kind of merged the ideas of distributed clusters or cycle scavenging, Condor, which is used to drive the HD Condor, which is used to drive the Open Science Grid, got its start back then as a cycle scavenging network, but only was later applied to clusters. And this led in the direction that I mentioned of grid computing. So people ask, because this stuff all preceded Jeff Bezos and company for by a long time. And they say, well, why do we hear about cloud now and we don't hear about grids? Cloud was the term that commercial enterprises applied to this work. And I tell them, well, we weren't smart enough to ask people for their credit card numbers. But otherwise, the technologies are very similar. There are some differences. We were deeply concerned with security. We wanted to prevent the biggest scientific computers from being used for illicit purposes. And so we had a very elaborate X509 extended attribute certificate proxy-based method. These methods are all built into modern cloud methods, SPIFFI and Spire projects, for example. They were new to people at the time, and they just wanted to log in with a username and password. They didn't want all these fancy certificates and keys and stuff. But when commercial cloud started, if you wanted to be root, all you had to do is give them a credit card number, right? So there was a, I always tell people that grids started from the point of view of security and were battling difficulties associated with a perception of poor ease of use ever since. Clouds started from the point of view of ease of use and have spent almost all the time since then battling perceptions of poor security. It's the same technology, it's just applied in different ways. But that was the bridge from, spending an equal amount of time on detector hardware and on software for me to transitioning to doing large-scale computing.
Is grid computing a competitor to cloud? And if so, why doesn't it feel, at least to me, like something that's championed more? Like right now, the story that I hear is HPC and cloud or versus cloud and convergence. And it feels like grid computing was this thing. This is my perspective, by the way. So this isn't what everyone thinks, but grid computing was this thing that kind of started and was picked up, but then cloud took over.
Yeah, so this is a good question. So first of all, grid computing is still around and still used in a large number of highly visible science fields. I mentioned gravitational waves. The LIGO network is a grid virtual organization. A large amount of sort of pre-committed computing where multiple institutions commit to the same kind of science still uses grid methods. In almost every case, they've been augmented by what we would call cloud methods, in the sense that you might find technologies like Kubernetes and so forth deployed in them. But the fundamental idea of an organization, we called them virtual organizations, that can gather agreements for access to resources and apply them to a particular field of science, that's still around. And the Open Science Grid is still here. The European Grid Initiative is still around, Asia Pacific Grid. So they're there, that's kind of in the background. A lot of the technologies that you use if you're doing any kind of science with collaborative infrastructures also depends a lot on things that were developed in the grid era. If you've ever used Perf Sonar to debug interinstitutional network links, that's based on work done by the Open Grid Forum. A lot of the standards and tools that underlie essentially all batch schedulers build in implementations of basic execution services, which is a grid forum standard, even before it became Open Grid Forum. So some of this stuff has just been integrated in. Clouds had some differences and still do. I take exception to the phrase, and I try to demolish it wherever I can find it. Unfortunately, popular phrase, public cloud. I tell people we have public parks, we have public roadways, we have public libraries. We do not have public clouds. All that we have are commercial clouds to which you can get access for a fee. So the concept of a public cloud entered people's mindset as an idea of a public resource, but in its implementation, almost all cloud resources, almost all, are not in the public domain, apart from the grid infrastructures that developed cloud capabilities like EGI. So clouds and grids are essentially the same technology. The one difference is in motivation. In a cloud environment, you might encounter the phrase multi-cloud, where a single organization makes use of multiple types of resources. This is essentially a grid concept. The idea of grids was you shouldn't have to care where things are executed. You should simply state your requirements. I need to analyze this data set. I need this much computing time. And the grid would work it out for you. With all this positive assessment, I have to inject a bit of reality. Grids were thought up in the era in which we needed to share resources to accomplish science goals. The world is a lot more complex in terms of security, in terms of threats, in terms of potential for misuse. And so we have to be a lot more careful when you build these infrastructures now. But it's also true in the cloud that you have to be careful. I would say that if we want to try to implement the idea of a grid now in the way that we did 20 years ago, we would immediately encounter the same kinds of security concerns that we encountered back then, but times 100, because there's just so many avenues for exploit. So that's made it less frequent to have institutions agree to, you know, share their computers. Nonetheless, it's done. To some degree, I'll finish the answer by saying that we have to simply face the idea that good ideas are reinvented periodically. The word you attach to them may change. A lot of people using the phrase AI here, I think largely without knowing what it means. I usually say that the biggest danger associated with AI is the probability that people might believe that it exists. But it is the buzzword of note right now, and pretty soon we'll call them AI infrastructures instead of clouds. What I was trying to get to is that these ideas get reinvented, and when you reinvent them, you have the opportunity to do them better. So a lot of grid technologies are still in use, but others need to be replaced. We no longer use X509 certificates for identity management. We've switched to something called site tokens. We've used more modern methods. What I believe we ought to do is to try to learn the lessons of the past implementations without reinventing them. I'm right now in the middle of responding to a thread on an email list that talks about external collaborator access. And I'm deeply concerned that people seem to be going back and missing these 20 years worth of lessons we've had in building these collaborative infrastructures. The easy part is the technology. The hard part is the policy. It's not necessary to rehash stuff that's been well understood. So it becomes a challenge to try to pass on a legacy, to try to establish what are those best practices and to put them out there in ways that are people that make it easy to learn. And this gives me an opportunity to answer, again, too long-winded an answer, but once more, why create HPC.social? if you think about this now from the point of view that I just described, it's absolutely in the field's best interest that people communicate, that they have low threshold, easily accessed, friendly avenues to ask these questions and to exchange information. So HPC.social and its various channels, Slack, Discord, Mastodon, whatever else people want to use, they're not just optional in my point of view. They're absolutely essential to not wasting time and not missing the lessons and to having the ability to quickly interchange information. It's not just a fun thing that we add on to the technology that we do. It's an absolutely essential piece of doing it in an efficient way.
I absolutely agree on that point. And also what you said about AI, I am very opinionated about that and I will withhold sharing my thoughts, but I'll just say that I agree. And just my quick naive impression about grid computing versus cloud or and cloud, whatever identifier you want to use in there, it's sort of my sense that at least as a developer, from my perspective, when I'm building things, I need to have a developer playground. I need to be able to own resources and be the root user and break them and bring them up and down, up and down. And I think that's something that cloud can offer that you wouldn't be able to get with grid computing. That said, I do think that these two worlds don't need to be so disparate. So if grid computing has APIs and it's very easy to run simulations and scientific workloads, maybe it's just that we're not communicating. We're not talking to these communities have come very separate, you know, people working on cloud and people working on grid computing. And if we talked more, we'd realize that actually there's a really good opportunity to have these two environments work together. So we can't have root on someone else's machine, but we can use the API to burst off work when we know that we need that.
Yeah.
So let's
Or
think
you
more
can
about
broaden
that.
the concepts. You can broaden the concepts we had with grid computing. We simply didn't know how safely to allow people to have root access. Cloud did solve that problem through the mechanism of financial restrictions, but we still have examples. You know, the COVID response provided a situation in which the U.S. and other, you know, globally, we spun up a collaborative infrastructure to share access to resources. These ideas will come around again and again. And the need for collaborative access, you know, when we built grids, we basically wanted to solve the problem that you had more work to do than you could get done on your institution's computer, and you wanted to use resources where they were available. There was a consequent consideration that the data sets were large and you wanted to move your computing to where the data existed rather than the other way around in some cases. So these are just, if you want to think about grid and cloud in one envelope, these are, we used to just say, just call it distributed computing. All I'm trying to point out is that the problems you run into for collaborative and shared access, these are persistent problems, and we should keep our methods of dealing with them updated because there will be another pandemic. There will be another, you know, urgent need for shared computing, and we should be able to respond to it.
I'm selfishly very grateful to have talked with you about this because, in my mind, I'm going to expand my kind of collection of things that I'm looking at to include grid computing and resources when I'm thinking about things that I've traditionally just kind of scoped to my local HPC clusters and then the cloud. The goals are so similar, if not totally overlapping, with some nuances of differences. I think there's huge opportunity for more communication, more collaboration, more development in that space.
Well, I feel really glad to hear that. I used to give a slide at the beginning of my talks. It's an elaborately drawn sign that said, "Welcome to the grid. Warning, your master plan may have to coexist with those of many others." I still sort of feel that way. I don't want to lose what lessons have been learned, but I also don't want technology to hold us back from addressing hard problems. And I'm really glad to know that there are people like you out there addressing these problems.
So we are definitely up on time. I want to ask one more quick question and then we'll close up. So you're obviously very passionate about a lot of technical things, but when you're not working, I guess, what do you like to do in your spare time?
I really love the outdoors. I spend as much time hiking as I can. I do less camping than I used to. When my sons were in scouts, I did a lot more of that. I had at times, partly because I taught it for a while, a hobby in astronomy. I do a little less of that now. I've gotten into single board computers for work lately. And all I will say on that is it's astonishing how much really sophisticated computing you can deploy for a very small expense. It's given me reasons to rethink some of my big cluster infrastructures based on what can be accomplished with just little ones, especially in the area of training. I think that I've gotten passionate about trying to build little single board clusters for a few hundred bucks that you can drop into high school classrooms, for example. That almost qualifies as a hobby, I guess.
I think so. So, Alan, it was super awesome having you on the show. I forgot to say thank you. You sent me an HPC Social dinosaur sticker in the mail, and he arrived safely, although with a little corner bitten off. I was really grateful for that. And just thank you for everything that you do for our community. You bring such a wealth of experience and wisdom, and it's just an absolute pleasure and privilege to chat with you.
Well, and likewise, and thanks for all your work as well.